History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by the U.S. Army, proudly honoring the men and women from every branch of our armed forces whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories out there, right there where you live, that really should not go untold. We want to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that pursuit, we gain so much. We're educated, we're entertained. Often we really end up inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. If you're a regular listener to Hometown Heroes, you know we've been counting down to the 75th anniversary of the Normandy invasion by hearing from people who were part of that massive assault on occupied France three quarters of a century ago. One perspective we haven't heard yet in that countdown is that of the paratrooper. There were more than 13,000 of them jumping behind enemy lines in those early morning hours of June 6, 1944. And here is what those men and about 175,000 Americans total heard on the eve of that invasion from the Supreme Allied Commander, General Dwight Eisenhower.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the great crusade toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man to man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air, and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home fronts have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
The words of General Dwight D. Eisenhower in launching Operation Overlord 75 years ago that would include more than 13,000 paratroopers, about 300 of which were pathfinders, specially trained and equipped paratroopers who hoped to lead those who followed right to their destinations. The late Maynard Beamy Beamesdurfer was one of those pathfinders, a distinction he came about quite unexpectedly.
Well, I met my uncle over there, and both being from the country of, like, I mean, the cities we were at and speaking, we just sat there and we were speaking Pennsylvania Dutch. And some officer was sitting in back of us, and I didn't know who he was. So he walked around the front after we were done. He says, "Are you Mr. Beamesdurfer?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "You report to headquarters." I said, "Wonder, I was in trouble a couple of times, but I didn't know what I did wrong this time." And I found out later, they pulled me out of headquarters and they sent us into the pathfinding area. Well, we trained there with the 9th Air Force for quite a while. We weren't allowed to talk to anybody outside that darn fence. And we did a lot of night jumping, and they brought us right back in and kept us in this closed area all the time. So that's how I became a pathfinder.
And for people who aren't familiar, what's the difference between a pathfinder and any other paratrooper in the 101st or 82nd?
There's not that much difference. We had just some, maybe a little bit more sand tables, and we had to learn how to use homing devices and different, we call them the old scarf that we put down as markers. The most of the thing was memory, and knew the area we were going in were imposed to be setting up or other fellows were coming in.
Well, and that's what I was getting at. Your job was a little different than theirs, and their jobs in many ways depended on how well you did your job, right?
Well, we think we did our job because we were pretty lucky. There was only a little over 300 of us that trained on the Pathfinders, and we didn't have too bad a plane ride going in like some of these fellows did, because we came in Iran, and I came down close to Carrington, and it was a little wet there because we came in water.
And I always say June 6th, but for you it was really June 5th, wasn't it?
We only went in there anywhere from an hour to 3 hours ahead of time. It all depends what unit left the field, and we had to hurry up and set up this stuff and hope we did a good job for it.
So tell us what your duties were, and were you anxious as you get ready for this big day? I'm sure you're focused on what you're doing. You're not maybe conscious of how massive an operation this is.
We really didn't know what we were getting into for sure. Some of us were pretty darn scared going across. We thought we were super people, but you could see when you looked at some of the guys, they were kind of breaking down a little bit. Our job was to try to set up the best we could for our fellow buddies that were coming in. And then our second job was to hope the engineers that were coming in with a special plane, they had the equipment. There was two dikes that where the bridges were, where that held the water back. And if we couldn't knock those out, that was our second job to help to show them where these spots were. We were using a new type of material, which I didn't know about, but the stuff was more powerful than we realized. So we had to help them to go in there and set this stuff up. And when they did, they set it off, they set us in the air, because the stuff was that powerful, it just knocked us around.
So the explosion knocked you back, knocked you in the air.
I didn't have no wounds from it. I had bad scratches and cuts, but it affected my ears and my bleeding from my mouth and stuff like that, because the pressure, you just don't realize how much pressure that stuff can do to you and how it throws you around. Then our job was we were right close to Carrington. Carrington was the main headquarters for all the German equipment. We tried to knock it out, I don't know how many times, and we lost so many men. And what happened after that, American or British command decided it was impossible to take it. So they bombed that place day and night, the English by night and Americans by day. The way they told us, they started from the outside and moved in. And we finally got into Carrington. There was just nothing left of that place. And what happened to the people? We seen a lot of dead Germans laying around and a lot of cattle and things like that, but we don't know what happened to all the people. We never did find out. But on the 50th anniversary, I was back, and that was the most beautiful city, again, you could ever see. It was all redone, and they had a big museum there, and they had us about maybe 4 hours going through the museum.
Can you talk about the American losses trying to take Carrington? Did you lose some friends there?
I lost most of my friends. On the Pathfinders, out of our 12 that went in with the one group, we lost 8 of them. Because when we landed there, we landed in a little bit of water, and we had to go to another spot because you can't set up equipment in water. We knew the Germans were all around us because there was a big barn that was burning. And we heard this firing over our heads and stuff until later on it got worse and worse all the time. We knew they were getting close, and if we couldn't depend on our troops that were coming in, we were told our chances of ever coming out of it would be almost impossible. They all start coming in, and we were mighty happy because they had got stronger, and after many days, they finally taken, as I told you, taken Carrington, what was left of it. We stayed in that area until, I think it was July 14th, they moved us back to England.
When you go in with a group of 12 guys and 8 of them are killed and you're one of the 4 left standing, is it hard not to think I might be next?
As I said, you're scared. Believe it or not, sometimes you don't control your bowels for being so scared. Yes, I was really worried. But I always carried a New Testament in my pocket, which my mother told me to always carry. And if that helped me through, I don't know. But I didn't have no bad cuts or wounds or bullet wounds, but I was cut up pretty bad. And I had concussion, but concussion don't give you a Purple Heart. Later on, back in England, we were given a special award for the ones that went in as Pathfinders. It's the English wings, just like we, the 3 of us, received the Canadian wings, because the Canadians do their jumping here. So we got the gold wings here from Canadians, and I got the gold wings from England. But our training started all over when we got back. I was no longer a Pathfinder then. I moved to a Company H in the 3rd Battalion, and I was moved up in rank a little. Our training started all over, but our groups weren't the same because H Company took a pretty hard licking. The 82nd and the 101st lost a lot of men, fought hard, in the belief that we knew we were doing the right thing.
The late Beamy Beamesdurfer, one of D-Day's Pathfinders. If you go to El Paso, Texas, you'll find the building that airborne veterans gather in today is now named in his honor. And you'll also find photos of his friend, Angel Romero, who jumped on D-Day with the 82nd Airborne Division's 508th Parachute Infantry Regiment.
We were supposed to have jumped in a little town called Saint-Savier-le-Vicomte. We were supposed to capture a bridge there. I wound up landing in a little town called St. Martin. We call it St. Martin. They call it San Martin. It's got another name on it, but it was real close to the beach. It would be about 10 to 12 miles from where we were supposed to land.
So what went wrong? Pilot error or disorientation or what?
All of the ones that you mentioned, everything went wrong, and actually everything went right. If we had landed where we were supposed to have landed, they would have annihilated us within 2 days. And as it was, we were confused, but the Germans were more confused because they had no idea how many had jumped. They reported at least 10 airborne divisions had jumped. It was to our advantage that was such a big mix-up.
The confusion worked in your favor. So what kind of conditions did you face, and when did you encounter the enemy?
Very soon after landing, like I said, we were very close to the beach, so just about as soon as we landed, there were some firefights, and there was a lot of running going back and forth, and maybe about 10, 12 minutes after we landed, there were 3 plane loads from the 101st that landed, almost on top of us. So nobody knew where to go, and there was a labor camp close to where we were, and I could understand some words that were being said in the labor camp. So I started talking in Spanish, and it was very, very difficult. Years later on, I found out that they spoke Catalan, but some words were in Spanish, and I asked them where St. Mary Iglesias was, and one of them said, way in the back, said, La Iglesia Santa Maria, in Spanish. So I said, yes, and then somebody opened the gate there, and we started talking with them. As much as I could understand, it was very difficult. I couldn't understand much. And they told us which way to St. Mary Iglesias. I've never been to St. Mary Iglesias, and I've never been to Saint-Savier-le-Vicomte. Never made it.
Sometimes God's plans are a little bit different than the way we or the military envision things working out. Were you scared? Did you feel the ever-present danger around you?
Not before. Like I said, we were trained mentally. And even after landing, I wasn't scared. The first time that I felt any type of fear was whether I could keep up with my comrades or not. That was my biggest fear then. And then, of course, encountering the snipers. They'd fire one shot, and we didn't know where it was coming from. And then it soaked in that you see your first buddy get shot or wounded, and you understand what it's all about. And then you realize that you're in something very, very different.
When was the first time that you were hit?
When it was the first time that I was wounded? It was on the 14th of June in a little town called Etienneville, right at the end of the hedgerows, and I was shot in the leg. We were hedgehopping each other. We were actually running from the Germans, and there was 8 of us, and one would run and the other 7 would fire and so on until we got away from them. I don't remember being shot because, like I said, we were running. I remember falling backwards and running. Quite a while later, we were in that little town, in a little church. We sat down, and one of the guys took off all of his equipment, started playing boogie-woogie and a piano there. And The guy next to me said, "What happened to your leg?" I said, "Nothing." "Why?" He said, "Look at it." And that's when it hurt. But I hadn't felt anything until then.
You think it was just the degree of mental intensity required to do what you were doing that kept you from feeling that pain?
Probably in part, and probably the excitement that was going on, the fear of getting shot, that we were outnumbered and we were outrunning them. No time to think about anything except survival, I guess. That's part of it.
And clearly, we would have none of these firsthand accounts from D-Day paratroopers if not for the strength of that survival instinct. That was the voice of Angel Romero. And a reminder, you can link to all the full-length original interviews with these D-Day paratroopers at hometownheroesradio.com. And we have a couple more of them to hear from when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Over 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.